This is Wolf's Campfire, and you're about to listen to Three Scary Deathly Encounters, Volume 2. You can also check me out on YouTube at youtube.com/wolfscampfire. Now with that said, whether you're sitting around a campfire, on the night shift, or even laying in bed, let my voice soothe your nightmares. Something Murdered Me in Every One of My Past Lives, written by Alyssa Galou. I believe that I'm stuck in a perverse and twisted version of my own hell. One in which the dearest person to me in each of my past life reincarnations is overtaken by a being that possesses them so completely that they manage to betray my confidence and infiltrate my safety and end me. The most clear life I can remember is as a young woman in the 1950s, post-World War II in the American South. I was 20 years old, and though my memories of looking in the mirror, I was beautiful. I had shoulder-length brown hair that curled at the edges in the classic 1940s-style bob, with bangs swept to the side, full red lips and strikingly blue eyes. I would always accent my eyes with just a bit of liner and mascara, and make them my most prominent feature. Throw on a full skirt and a cardigan draped over my shoulders, and I had no problem snagging my husband after the war. We had grown up throughout the hard times, and turned 18 right as the war was ending. So, we were full of optimism and brimming with opportunities for the future. Johnny and I dated for approximately 3 months before he got down on one knee. I knew in my soul on that second date that I was going to marry this man. My mama never was too big on spending all her time in the house, and raised me to be as independent as a woman of that time could be. And I knew that wanting to be a stay-at-home mama to my kids was my choice, and not a choice that Johnny got to make for me. He respected my choice to raise our kids on my own, and supported my decision to re-enter the workforce when I decided it was time. The other guys I had dated always told me they wanted me to be in the home with the kids, and that just never sat right with me. Johnny was the only fellow to actually listen to me when I spoke dreamily about the future that I wanted. We got married at 19 years old and bought our first house together. It was a tiny little thing on the outside of the city, but it had a wide front porch and a backyard for the kids to play in, and inside just didn't matter to us. We could turn that house into a home that we always wanted with a little bit of work. And besides, Johnny was good with his hands and knew we could turn this place, for us, into retirement. A couple months after the wedding, I was expecting our first child, and I had never seen a wider smile on a man when I told my Johnny that he was going to be a father. He cried and fell to his knees, clasping my hands. I sat on the ground with him, and we just cried together for a bit, taking in the feeling of creating something larger than both of us. I think it hit him a little bit harder than me, since his daddy wasn't around growing up. I knew he was going to be the best father to our children that I could ever imagine. The months dragged on, and I quit my job at the grocery store ringing up fruits and vegetables to focus on creating a nursery and a welcoming environment for our new addition. Johnny made that cradle by hand, and I still remember that look of pride on his face when he brought that into our bedroom and sat it right next to his side of the bed. No one in his world was looking forward to that brand new addition than my Johnny was. Baby Aggie was born in June, and my heart had never felt so full. I thought I knew true love when I saw Johnny waiting at the end of the aisle for me, and my daddy walked me down to meet him. But the minute I laid eyes on that perfect little girl, I knew nothing would compare to this absolute feeling of bliss that I felt at this moment. The nurse walked outside to the waiting room to go fetch Johnny, and he walked into the hospital room with his eyes already gleaming with tears. As he took her out of my hands, he caressed her face with just one finger, and I knew that little girl had his entire being wrapped around her tiny little finger. We were so completely happy with those first few months. Johnny took some time off work when Aggie was born, which all of our friends loved to tease him about. They didn't understand why he had to be there if I was going to take care of the baby all the time, but you couldn't tell Johnny that. He had to be there for her, and there was no changing his mind on it. It sounds completely cliché, but I had never been so happy in my life as watching Johnny sit with Aggie in the living room on the carpet, listening to the radio. He just sat smiling down on her as I snuck glances at the two of them in between washing dishes in the kitchen. Ironically, in that moment, something changed and I would never be that happy in my lifetime again. I watched Johnny wiggling a rattle in front of Aggie's face, when suddenly, his head slowly moved upwards, eye level with the sofa, and the rattle gently fell to his side. Aggie didn't like the sudden stopping of attention, and she started to slow cry to attempt to get his attention on her again. When that first cry didn't work, it turned into an all-out wail from the living room, and still, Johnny never took his eye off the something directly in front of his face. I put down the dishes I had in my hands and swooped the baby off the floor with wet fingers, dragging along the carpet. With a sudden stopping of the baby's cry, Johnny snapped his attention toward me and smiled, but his smile was off. It took him just a millisecond too long to recognize the facial expression and to have his eyes match the expression on the rest of his face. In addition to the weird timing of his emotions, the smile seemed much too wide for his face. It's almost as if he was trying to mimic the smiles he saw of overly happy children that we saw in the movies. I turned the baby away from him and suggested that he go take a nap. He said that he was tired and robotically moved to get up from his seated position on the floor. When he finally stood up, he made a motion to walk, and then stopped and looked down at his feet, and turned his head ever so slightly to the right, as if remembering how to make his body move forward. Still looking down at his feet, his right leg moved completely vertically upwards and slammed back down in front of him much too hard. His gaze turned to the other leg, and the same thing happened. This continued down the short hallway to our bedroom, in which he jerkily turned and shut the door behind him. I put the baby down for a nap and finished up my things in the kitchen, and a couple hours later when Johnny woke up, he seemed to be a little bit better. He certainly was walking better at least. So, I just kinda brushed it off as a trick of both of our minds when we were tired. I know a lack of sleep can do some funny things, and that's what must have happened to Johnny. We carried on like this for a few days until Johnny went back to work. He left in the morning around 6 a.m., planted a soft kiss on both my forehead and the baby's, and grabbed his briefcase for work. I did my cleaning and jobs around the house, and laid my head down on the sofa while the baby was taking her mid-morning nap. I couldn't have been out for too long, but I was awakened by a strange feeling in my gut. I knew something was wrong, but I had a feeling that I shouldn't open my eyes just yet. I sat there, eyes closed, taking in my surroundings for a few seconds, and that's when I heard it. A slow, methodic breathing located directly above my face. It was a ragged type of breathing. Like someone had just run a mile, but was trying to breathe slower to force their lungs to acclimate to the lack of exertion. I decided to open my eyes and face whatever was above me. My husband was directly above me, eyes less than 6 inches from mine, straddling my blanket-covered body. I was completely trapped by his weight above me. His gaze met mine, and his face spread into that slow and much too wide smile that took his body just a few days ago. Our eyes kept meeting, and there was no effort or indication that he was going to break eye contact anytime soon. His smile was getting wider, and his mouth was ever so parted with that cheek achingly large smile, that a small bit of drool was beginning to pile around his lower lip and was threatening to break the dam that held it back. I looked down to take in my surroundings, and that's when I noticed the slight glint in my eye that hadn't been there before. Looking down at the rest of my body, I saw the knife situated directly in Johnny's hands. He was gripping the handle of a kitchen knife with both hands so tightly that his knuckles were turning white from the force. The blade quivered as his hands faltered, being held without support above my breasts for so long. I look back up at his face, and his eyes never left as the knife plunged into my chest. It was a slow and meticulous process. He knew exactly where to position that knife, and knew exactly how slow to move it to keep me just on the brink of extinction. As the knife scraped at what was left of my life, Johnny collapsed upon me, driving the knife further and cementing my fate. As I saw the edges of my vision turning black, the baby started screaming in her cradle, and I felt a cry escape my lips. I looked down to see Johnny again slumped over my bleeding form, and noticed a black wisp emanating from the back of his neck. It seemed to emerge slowly at first, and then with more force, gathering almost as a cloud of smoke directly over where I laid. In a matter of seconds, a giant cloud of black mist had extricated itself from the body of my husband and gathered directly over me. It formed the rough shape of a man that moved to stand on the floor, looking down at my almost lifeless body laid out on the sofa. Ever so slowly, the completely black and featureless form of this man bent down so that what would be his face was directly eye level with mine. I felt tears streaming down my face, and a whimper escaped my lips as I heard words reverberate throughout my head. He didn't have features, so it was impossible to hear the words out loud, but somehow, I still completely understood the message he was trying to get across to me. All he said was, "Nice to see you again. Until next time." Since then, I've been reincarnated multiple times, and each time, I meet the same end. Someone I love more than anyone in the world kills me for absolutely no reason in the peak happiness that I experience in that lifetime. And every single time the life is about to drain out of me in that existence, a black mist swirls out of the body of my loved one and declares another message of triumph over me. I have no idea what this thing is or what it wants with me, and there's absolutely no way for me to know when my ultimate demise is coming. I've been exploring options in understanding and remembering other versions of my past self to learn any sort of clues as to what may have caused this, and how I stop it before it happens to me again in this life. I won't let it happen to me again. Smiley Face Murders, written by Prime Thoracic 2. A few weeks ago, I made a new friend while shopping at my local store. His name is Doug. We were both browsing the same aisle, and I noticed he was wearing YouTuber merch that I also owned. So, I struck up a conversation with him. He seemed like a cool dude, so we exchanged numbers. About a week later, he invited me to hang out, and I agreed, and I'm not gonna lie, I got pretty excited to finally make a new friend in the somewhat isolated town I lived in. We decided to go to the local bar to grab a few drinks. While we were there, we were talking about basically everything. I was wondering how we never met, considering the size of my town. So, I asked him why I had never seen him before. He told me that he had just moved into the town due to work-related stuff. Boy, was I lucky, because this place was kind of boring. I then asked him what he did for work, and oddly enough, he told me he couldn't get into it. I thought this was strange, and honestly, it should have raised some red flags. While we were about to talk to a couple of girls who were looking over at us, he got a call and told me he had to leave for work-related stuff. I told him it was all good, so we both decided to head out. Once I got home, I texted him to see if he made it to where he had to go all right, and he replied with, "Yeah, I'm gonna be busy, so don't text me until tomorrow." I respected it, and I called it a night. The next morning, I had to go into work early because of one of our guys had to quit, so I was the one who was going to go pick up the slack. While heading out the door, I saw Doug's truck and then saw him speed off. I thought this was a bit weird, but I didn't think anything of it because I did live in a somewhat small town. The day went by pretty slowly, and I was glad when it was finally time to clock out. The great thing about where I work is that we have our own little garage-style parking lot that is for employees only. While I was getting into my car, I saw Doug's truck on the outside of the parking lot, and again, he just peeled off. I started to get a bit concerned at this point, because he hasn't texted me, and I've seen him at my house and at my workplace today. I decided to text him with, "Hello, how's it going?" He then replied with, "Things are going good. I had to do some things for work today. We should hang out tonight at the local bar again." I stupidly agreed with the idea, even though I was having my concerns. Maybe I was just being paranoid, and I didn't see him, and it was someone else who I thought it was him. The night finally reached me, and it was time to meet Doug at the bar. When I arrived, I saw his truck was already parked. When I got closer to the truck, I saw that there was mud all over his tires and that he had a smiley face sticker on his truck. When I saw this, I was wondering why he was out of town, as our town is mainly paved and doesn't have too many dirt roads, other than the ones out of town, of course. When I headed inside, I saw Doug, except this time, he was with two other people. One was a skinny girl who looked to be in her 40s, and a taller masculine dude who looked about the same age. When I approached, I said, I wasn't expecting company, and then he told me they were co-workers of his, who he invited without me knowing. I thought this was strange, but I went along with it anyways. While we were drinking, his co-worker started to ask me a lot of personal questions. I thought this was weird, so I tried my best to dodge all of them. It was getting pretty late, and I decided to call it a night. His friends said I was way too drunk to drive home, so they offered me a ride. I declined and said I would get a taxi to take me home. Weirdly enough, they kept on insisting they take me home, almost as if they had to. I told them it was okay, and I then called a taxi. When I called a taxi, their mood switched and they almost seemed to have an angry expression on their face. The taxi arrived and I was ready to call it a night when I got home. The next morning I woke up to no messages by Doug, and honestly, I felt relieved. It's been 5 days since I last heard from Doug. I figured it was because I refused to let them take me home that night. While I was at home, I randomly decided to turn on the news. What I saw made my chest drop. The local police had found 5 bodies with a smiley face tagged near their corpses. I then connected the dirty tires and the smiley face on Doug's truck and proceeded to call the police. They arrived at my house, and I told them everything along with a description of all of them. What really haunts me to this day is when the police officer told me, and I quote, "You're lucky you didn't go home with him that night. You would have never made it home. Be careful who you make friends with, and if you see red flags, then go with your gut and cut them off." I narrated a murder confession, written by ObjectiveTel6047. I guess to begin with, I had a career of narrating creepypastas on YouTube. Originally, it started out as a hobby, but I eventually got to a point where I could do it full-time and make a decent living out of it. I'd been interested in creepypastas for a few years and listened to a lot of narrators. My favorite was always Demon Creep. Whenever he read stories or did LPs on his channel, I had written my own stories and sent them to him. It gave me the idea of, I want to do this as well. So, I practiced and practiced my storytelling abilities, and with some tech classes, I began my own YouTube channel. I would narrate other people's stories I found on Reddit, and on occasion, narrated my own. I would even post non-creepypasta-related material like music and videos. I did some experimentation with ASMR, but found that to be very unlike me. My narration voice had a Let's Read or a King Spook kind of quality, a deep, velvety tone with a hint of something sinister behind it, like a madman's lullaby. Sorry, I guess I got some of Leanne Vickers' sense of poetics as well. Now, if you're wondering about my channel and want to check it out, don't bother. I deleted it, as well as all my social media and fundraising accounts, and changed my email. I made sure no trace of my work exists anywhere on the internet anymore. After what I had just gone through, I felt like it was the best to delete everything. To me, one story could make or break my career. You can probably guess which one I happened upon. One story I received, one that practically got me arrested, turned out to not be a story at all. It was a murder confession. Now, sometimes I would go to creepypasta.com and select stories there, but I also had a subreddit in which people could submit their own stories to me. This story came through there. It was submitted by a user I didn't recognize or had never seen. I can't give any details about it because, as far as I know, everything is still under investigation. The story went as follows. I was driving down a dark road in an almost blinding rain. The back road was slick and wet that I nearly drove myself into a ditch. It would have been very easy to drive off the road and get into an accident if I didn't have my headlights and high beams on. I was listening to the local radio broadcast, being informed of some missing people from the tri-state area. All were young women with seemingly no connection to each other. After a while, the rain had finally stopped, and I could see everything a little more clearly. The clouds overhead had parted, and the moon had revealed her rays on this back road. Up ahead, I could make out the shape and lights of a parked car on the side of the road, the blinkers signaling hopefully any other traveler out tonight. As I got closer, I could make out the shape of a person leaning against the vehicle, wearing a bright yellow coat. I got closer and found that it was a young woman standing outside her car. She was pretty enough, to be sure. She was naturally tan-skinned and matching hazel brown hair. Her bright raincoat was the only other source of brightness around there. The most striking feature about this woman that I had noticed before anything else was her eyes. They were the shade of green, like a pair of emeralds. They were a seemingly otherworldly shade of green. "Are you okay?" I asked the girl.
"My car started acting up and died. My phone isn't working either. Can I get a lift?"
she asked, with her face full of gloom. I told her I'll be happy to help her out. Those kind words brought a smile to her sad face instantly.
"Oh, thank you so much,"
she squealed as she practically jumped into the passenger seat. I drove off, leaving her lonely car behind in the darkness. She turned out to be going in the same direction I was, so giving her a lift wasn't too big of a deal. We rode in relative silence for a while, aside from the radio station still reporting on the missing people. She was quiet amidst the reporting, maybe knowing someone who went missing or feeling uncomfortable with the subject matter. I found myself making quick glances at her. Besides the wetness of her clothing and her hair, she was pretty. "So, where are you heading?" I asked curiously.
"I'm just heading home,"
she responded, not taking her eyes off the road.
"I spent more time with my friends tonight than I should have, so I had to go back. I got hit with the rain and my car started acting up on me."
"You mean just friends or boyfriend?" I asked bashfully. She turned and gave a friendly smile at me.
"Just friends,"
she informed me, and I smiled back at her.
"Where are you heading from?"
she asked me. "I'm just coming back from a shift," I told her. "I'm a carpet cleaner." She nodded back at me. It was a few minutes before we said anything else.
"Thanks again for helping me. I don't know what I would have done if you hadn't shown up."
I glanced at her, again hypnotized by her eyes. "You know, you should really be careful when hitchhiking or flagging down a ride. You don't know what kind of psycho is out there. The person behind the kidnappings could have gotten you instead of someone else." Her smile faded, and she nodded.
"Interesting fact. Did you know Edmund Kemper, the co-ed killer, picked up hitchhikers and killed them at a remote spot?"
"Oh, really?" A look of nervousness had begun to carve on her face. "I'm sorry," I said, with a slight chuckle. I have an interest in abnormal psychology and serial killers, and I tend to blurt out facts at random.
"No, it's okay, it's kind of fascinating,"
she said with a slight laugh. I could tell she was trying to hide her discomfort by wearing a fragile mask of politeness. Given her predicament, she had no choice but to take a ride with some random person. We didn't say anything else for a while as we drove onward. I later assured her I knew a shortcut as I turned on another street in the backwoods area. I knew this spot very well. It was a quiet area, especially this time of night. I slowed the car to a stop, telling my passenger I made a wrong turn. I made her believe I was reaching for my phone to pull out a map. Instead, I pulled out my switchblade and shoved the knife into her exposed neck. She never had the time to respond. After pulling the knife out of her flesh, the blood flowed out of her neck like red ribbons on her skin. She began suffocating while looking at me with terror. She had exited the vehicle while losing more and more blood. I laughed, knowing full well that she'd be dead well before any help came along. All she had to go on was just the slightest bit of hope for survival. This was a sight I took delight in, just seeing how far they'd go before they collapse from blood loss and the body gives out. She had gone about 5 feet away from the road and into the clearing before her knees buckled and she collapsed under her own weight. She had writhed on the ground after making contact with the cold, damp earth. I admit, she had gone farther than I expected her to. The last one never made it even 2 feet away from me before the same thing happened. I lit up a Marlboro and waited for her to finish dying. She gave some small twitches as I observed her at a distance. When I stopped hearing noises coming from her,
I walked over to her still, dead form. A quick nudge from my boot informed me that she was, in fact, lifeless. Aside from her eyes remaining open, I made the quick work of plucking out her green eyes and placed them in a jar I keep in the trunk. I drove off, leaving my victim behind in the darkness. Someone might find her later. I don't want to be here when they do. This story made for a short video, but it became a success overnight. I had countless views and comments, all saying how real this story felt, and the others making crude jokes about the murder. I admit, I even thought it was real for a second. It was as if I were observing the events through the killer's eyes. I didn't realize how real it turned out to be. It was a day or two later, late morning, when I heard a knock at my door. I opened it to be greeted by two police officers in a squad car in my driveway. They got my identification, and I was escorted by them to the car. They didn't mention that I was under arrest, but rather that they had questions for me. I felt obligated to go along and cooperate. I waited in an interrogation room, complete with a simple desk, one chair, and what I assumed to be a two-way mirror. Someone might have been on the other side, deciding what to do with me. All that went through my mind was what happened that got me in here. After a long time, two people entered. The man was a burly white male in a white collared shirt and rolled-up sleeves. I don't know what health issues he had, but sweat seemed to have glistened his exposed arms and face. The other person was an African-American woman in a purple coat and skirt. I was thinking one of them may have been a detective, and the other was an actual cop. They had come inside, and their stoic faces had stared right into me. "We understand you have a YouTube channel, right?" the woman asked. I had answered affirmative. They inquired about my latest video, about a murder. I told them about it, and asked what was going on that I was there. They answered me, and the explanation still gives me a feeling of nausea and freezes my blood. About 7:30 a.m. in the previous morning, two civilians were driving down Old Country Road, an unpaved dirt road just outside of town. They stopped on the road due to a flat tire. While changing to a new one, the passenger noticed a strange white shape in the clearing off the road in the grass. They had gotten close enough to see the shape better, and screamed loud enough to break the morning silence. The sight of a body was a young girl, mutilated and dead. She laid still, pale and damp from a mix of morning dew and dried blood. There was an obvious knife wound in her neck, aimed right at the jugular vein, so she would bleed out the quickest. That wasn't the only detail about this gruesome discovery. There was also two bloodied holes where her eyes should have been, two red, dark caverns in a frozen face that had become home to insects. An ambulance and the police made it to the scene and began the investigation. The victim in question still had her ID and wallet with her. The killer obviously didn't want anything of monetary value from her, but I know what they did want. The one detail on her card that stuck with me was her eye color, green. The police had other leads in the Tri-City area. There were other reports of women either going missing or being found as bloodied corpses, all with missing eyes. This killing spree had been going on for about a year now. The only two things that linked these victims together was that they were all given a ride by someone else due to car problems, and their eyes were some shade of green. This person who they called the Green Eye Killer was still at large as far as they knew. The details of the scene weren't yet known to the public at any time my video came out. The police were digging for details and clues, and somehow, one of them caught my video and linked me to the murder. I told them the details about how I got the story submitted to me a couple nights ago on Reddit. They were skeptical about my explanation, but decided to keep me in a cell until they decide what to do with me. They did a search of my house and checked my laptop. After a few hours of finding the story like I told them and finding nothing else to link me to the crime, they let me go, but they kept my computer for a while. I didn't follow the details of the investigation after being let go. I eventually got my laptop back, and when I did, the first thing I did was tell my fanbase about what happened, and that I made the toughest choice of my life. I thanked everyone for all the love and support, and I deleted everything. My Reddit page, my channel, my social media accounts, and my fundraising accounts were all deleted. I got rid of everything because I didn't want to go through another incident like that. Worse, I hated the idea of profiting off a murder just for views. I'll end with a warning. If you're a young woman with green eyes and your car breaks down during the night, be careful who you get a ride from,